Today's reading is from Luke chapter 11, verses 37 to 54. And as Mark mentioned, that's on page 42 in your little green Luke's Gospels. Starting at verse 37. While Jesus was speaking, a Pharisee asked him to dine with him. So he went in and reclined at table. The Pharisee was astonished to see that he did not first wash before dinner. And the Lord said to him, "Now you Pharisees cleanse the outside of the cup and of the dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness. You fools, did not he who made the outside make the inside also? But give as alms those things that are within, and behold, everything is clean for you. But woe to you Pharisees, for you tithe mint and rue and every herb, and neglect justice and the love of God. These you ought to have done, without neglecting the others. Woe to you, Pharisees, for you love the best seat in the synagogues and greetings in the marketplaces. Woe to you, for you are like unmarked graves, and people walk over them without knowing it." One of the lawyers answered him, "Teacher, in saying these things, you insult us also." And he said, "Woe to you lawyers also, for you load people with burdens hard to bear, and you yourselves do not touch the burdens with one of your fingers. Woe to you, for you build the tombs of the prophets, whom your fathers killed. So you are witnesses, and you consent to the deeds of your fathers, for they killed them, and you build their tombs. Therefore also the wisdom of God said, 'I will send them prophets and apostles, some of whom they will kill and persecute, so that the blood of all the prophets shed from the foundation of the world may be charged against this generation, from the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah, who perished between the altar and the sanctuary. Yes, I tell you, it will be required of this generation. Woe to you lawyers, for you have taken away the key of knowledge. You did not enter yourselves, and you hindered those who were entering.' As he went away from there, the scribes and the Pharisees began to press him hard and to provoke him to speak about many things, lying in wait for him to catch him in something he might say."
Richard, thank you very much indeed for reading. May I add my welcome to you? It's very good to see you, especially if you're here as an occasional visitor. I hope you'll make it a regular thing and block it out in the diary so you'll be able to be with us every week as we listen to God's word. Now, our subject this afternoon is something all of us, I think, dislike intensely, and we're going to be looking at hypocrisy and phony pretense. You may know, if you've been coming regularly, that I've called this series Due Diligence, and we are putting religion under the microscope and asking whether it holds up under scrutiny. It's fair to say, I think, that all of us detest hypocritical, phony pretense, especially in religion, even though I suspect that all of us are able to spot it to our shame in ourselves. Before we get to the issue of the day, I want to spend a few minutes recapping on the last few sections in Luke's Gospel and reminding us of an emphasis that I had to correct last week. You'll remember that we were looking at the one sign that Jesus promised to give to us as proof that he is who he says he is. The sign Jesus has given is the sign of his death and resurrection, and the ongoing announcement of that historic life-changing event. So there's one sign, says Jesus, the sign of his death and resurrection, and it will be proclaimed down through eternity. And that sign, with its proclamation, is the evidence and the proof that we need in order to believe. Those who asked for the sign, if you just turn back a page from our reading and have a look at chapter 11, verse 16, you will see that they asked for the sign in order to test Jesus. And that was the attitude which I think I failed to emphasize sufficiently when I spoke on it. So there were people in Jesus' day who refused to listen to him, who went on procrastinating and prevaricating, just putting things off and quibbling over every tiny detail. They were contrary and fickle, and they refused to be persuaded by Jesus, even though he had been giving them clear evidence as to who he was and why he'd come. And eventually, Jesus' patience ran out. So he says, "No sign will be given except the sign of my death and resurrection," what he calls the sign of Jonah, and the announcement of that historic event. And the mistake I think I made when I spoke on it was to apply it primarily to us, to the believing disciples, rather than recognizing that the main focus of application as Jesus spoke was to the world. Now, it may be that there are some prevaricating procrastinators here, people who are actually putting off making a decision about Jesus and quibbling about every tiny detail. Oh, give us a sign. No, I won't do anything until I have a clear sign from Jesus. In which case, the message for you is, look, stop putting it off. You have the word of Jesus' death and resurrection. There is evidence. It happened in history. Now be careful how you listen and make sure that you listen. And that's for somebody who's just been putting things off. But the bulk of us, I guess, are not people looking to put Jesus to the test like the people in verse 16. And therefore, Luke's aim in including this material for us is that so that we can have confidence as believers when we come across people who put off and make excuse and put up a kind of smokescreen of more and more questions, even though the evidence is there on the table for us to look at. Don't be fazed as you come across people, even here in the city, who refuse to examine the evidence and ask you to kind of make Jesus into a modern-day Paul Daniels, producing another sign and a wonder, and another sign and a wonder, and another sign and a wonder. Now, don't feel under pressure to have to do that. There is just one sign. The sign of the death and resurrection of Jesus, says Jesus. And it's proclamation. No need for endless signs and wonders down through every century. Just one sign. Trust the preaching of it. Now, precisely the same direction of application is appropriate in the lesson Luke had to teach us immediately preceding last week. And I want to spend a little bit of time on that because it's very important when we come to this week's lesson. If you look at chapter 11, verse 15, you'll see that some people in Jesus' day accused Jesus of having his power from the devil. They said, he casts out demons by the power of Beelzebul. Now, once again, I very much doubt that there are many people here this afternoon who think that Jesus was essentially funded and promoted, you might say, by evil. There were such people in Jesus' day, and there are such people in the city today. So if you listen to the radical fundamentalist atheists, you will know that the Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens of this world argue that religion is evil, and that if you bring your child up to be Christian and teach them the Bible and say your prayers with them, you are engaging in the equivalent of child abuse. That's actually what they say. To which we can say, well, when somebody says to us, well, I think religion, all religion is evil, and actually to follow Jesus and to try and persuade people to follow him is a wrong thing to do, we can say, well, actually, there were people who said exactly the same thing in Jesus' day. There's nothing new about that. And Jesus showed that such an argument is illogical, plain wrong, and unprofitable. Now, I think that to understand the direction of the argument and who it is that Jesus is speaking to in these circumstances is really important. It's very helpful for us. God willing, I hope, there will be in the region of 4,000 people coming through St Helens, hopefully many more in the next few weeks, as we invite our friends and colleagues to various different carol services. As you walk away from the carol service and talk about what you hear, your friends and colleagues will say to you, some of them, well, actually, I would believe if I had more evidence. We need a modern-day sign. What are you going to say to them? Do you know, actually, in the time of Jesus, people were asking exactly the same thing. And Jesus says, no, there's just one sign, the historical event of his death and resurrection, and its announcement, its preaching down through the years. Let's go back and think about the death and resurrection of Jesus. Do you see? See how relevant it is? And you may have somebody else who comes who leaves absolutely livid. That has happened at carol services. In fact, one or two people who've become Christians after carol services have become Christians, having come to a service and been so angry that they determined to find out more so that they could really slate it in the office, and then they became Christians. That often happens. And they might leave really angry and say, well, this is just wicked and evil. How dare you say that sort of thing? To which you say, do you know there were people who said exactly the same thing in Jesus' day? The Pharisees were, that was precisely their argument. Let me take you back to Luke chapter 11, and you can see that it's an illogical argument, it's reasonable to believe, it's a wrong argument, it's right to believe, and it's unprofitable both for you and for our culture, if you follow that line of thinking. You see how relevant it is to the world in which we find ourselves. Now today, I've got so excited, I lost my place in my notes, that's what's happened today, but here we go. Today there is a third type of detractor. And I love Luke's method. He's just taking us through. Obviously, he'd spent time with the Apostle Paul, hadn't he? Travelled the world. And as Paul went into the marketplace or the synagogue and argued through, he'd met all these kind of people. And so Luke includes this material for us. Here is a third type of detractor. You will have noticed that the language of today's passage is incredibly strong. Did you spot it? In fact, it's so strong that some preachers and commentators have shied away from this passage. In fact, my second confession for the afternoon is that I preached all the way through Matthew's Gospel in 1998 to the year 2000 when I first arrived as rector of St Helens. And at least I thought I preached all the way through Matthew's Gospel. And when I was preparing for this a couple of weeks ago, I went back to my Matthew folder. I thought, I wonder what I said about this when I was in Matthew 23. And I found there was a great blank. And we must have finished the series in Matthew 22 just before Christmas and picked up again after Christmas in Matthew 24, having missed this passage altogether. So I am to blame as well. But look at the strength of the language. Verse 42. You fools. Literally, you mindless ones. And then six times, woe to you, verse 42. Woe to you, verse 43. Woe to you, verse 44. Same in 46, 47, and 52. The woe was a form of condemnation delivered by the prophets in the Old Testament, pronouncing God's curse on a people. Notice that the context is a dinner party. Can you imagine if you were the host, this Pharisee who'd invited Jesus to dine with him? Three times Jesus is invited to dine by Pharisees, I was told by Wes, just as we came in this afternoon. And on each occasion, it ended in the most unfortunate manner for the host. But can you imagine the social embarrassment as Jesus pronounces woes on the guests? Some have argued that it's anti-Semitic. It isn't. There's no mention of race or ethnicity at all. And many of Jesus' audience would have agreed with him. Some have suggested that it's just unreasonable. It isn't. The Pharisees have been cruising for a fight with Jesus since chapter 5. They've grumbled at him. They've been filled with fury at him. They've tried to do away with him. They've rejected God's purposes for themselves. They've accused Jesus of being satanic. They've put him to the test again and again and again. So this is not unreasonable. It's actually rather refreshing. But eventually, Jesus' patience will run out with the person who tries to hide behind a smokescreen of excuses and their own veneer of respectability, rather than face up to the truth that Jesus has come to teach. But remember that the Pharisees and the lawyers here does not describe the believing disciple. Yes, all of us have got Pharisaic tendencies within us, but do you think Jesus is of the devil? No, you don't. Are you putting Jesus to the test every 5 minutes? Well, I trust you aren't, because you're trusting his death and resurrection. Are you doing what the Pharisees do at the end of this situation, lying in wait for him to catch him in something he might say? No, you're not. So the primary point of reference of this section is to the kind of religious hypocrisy that thinks it can sidestep Jesus' forgiveness by hiding the need for Jesus' forgiveness, by hiding behind a veneer, a smokescreen of religious performance. You see, I could stand here and take the Pharisees and address you and myself with a great big stick and make us all feel incredibly guilty. Yes, there are Pharisaic tendencies in all of us, but we are not the Pharisees. This is addressed to those who erect this great smokescreen of religious, ritualistic performance, saying, well, I don't need Jesus and his forgiveness because I'm perfectly decent. And let me tell you, as you walk away from the carol service with your guest, there will be many, many people who say that. Oh, I keep all the social norms. Oh, yes, I've never done any harm to anybody. Oh, yes, I'm a decent person. How dare the preacher say I need forgiveness? That is precisely the person and the culture to whom this passage is addressed. You see the three types of people that Luke is lining up for us. The person who says Jesus is of the devil, the person who puts Jesus to the test, and the person who is self-righteous and says, well, I don't need the forgiveness of Jesus Christ. I'm a perfectly decent human being. The Pharisee. We're not going to have time for the lawyer. Incidentally, the lawyer is not a member of the magic circle. Jesus is not saying, woe to you, Freshfields partner. Woe to you, Clifford Chance board member, or anything like that. No, the lawyer is the religious legal expert. So if you were hoping that we were going to have a real dig at the lawyers amongst us, I'm sorry to disappoint you. And we'll tackle the lawyers next week. They are the clergy. This week, the Pharisees, and the Pharisees were laymen, very religious laymen. Many of them were business people, like you are. And there are seven condemnations, four directed to the Pharisee. First, you practice an outward religion. It barely cloaks your greed. Just have a look at verse 39. Now, you Pharisee, you cleanse the outside of the cup and of the dish, but inside you're full of greed and wickedness. You mindless ones. Did not he who made the outside make the inside also? Give as alms those things that are within, and behold, everything is clean for you. Here then is a thin veneer of external activity. Oh, very religious, highly ritualistic. They washed their pots. They took care not to mingle with the unclean. They had their manifestos of politically correct behavior. They had the way you behaved in society, how you treated your superiors and how you treated your inferiors. They purified themselves with their rituals and their sacrifices. But on the inside, peel back the skin. Have a look. Their thought life, their attitudes and ambitions. Glance at their bank balances and at their email correspondence. And what does Jesus see? Wickedness and greed. You know, the greengrocer hands you a beautiful rosy apple. It sometimes happens at this time of year, doesn't it? You think, oh, tremendous, fresh from the orchards of Kent, absolutely lovely, and it looks so luscious, and you sink your teeth into it, and it's just cotton wool. Don't think, says Jesus, that your external pretense can paper over the internal putrefaction. You mindless ones. Did not he who made the outside of the cup make the inside as well? Do you think God can't see? He made you. He sees you. So you can attend your mass religiously. You can do your puja conscientiously. You can perform your Muslim salat 5 times a day with meticulous care at the mosque. You can be the most politically correct, diversity aware, socially conscious, environmentally friendly man or woman in the Western world. But all of that's just window dressing. Your externalism fails to fool God. He can see the inside. I was reading in my own personal reading just this morning that God sees the inside. He knows our thoughts. He sees our email correspondence. He knows us inside out. Now, already we can begin to see the direction of application. As I've thought about this through the week, you know, very easy to chase back to the first century, but every single culture has its own religious ritual, which it uses to big up its own performance and to avoid the scrutiny of God. I'm reading at the moment a book called The Whisperers. Some of you may have come across it. It was at one of your recommendations, actually, that I picked it up to read it. It's about the Soviet Union in the 1920s and the 1930s and the Bolshevik Revolution. Oh, the Bolshevik Revolution, though atheistic, was absolutely full of ritual, things you do and don't do in order to be recognized as politically correct. I've just been to Bangladesh, as you know. I mean, that largely Islamic culture is full of ritual by which you establish that you're in and that you're kosher, if you don't mind me crossing religions, if you see what I mean. Well, materialistic Western world, we have exactly the same sort of thing, whether it's politically correct language or whether it's the way we behave in the office, by which we say, well, I'm really rather decent and I don't need the forgiveness of Jesus. To which Jesus says, well, woe to you if you really hold that. I can see the inside and I know your wickedness and your greed. So you cannot, don't allow your outward practice to cloak your inner greed. God knows, God sees. Don't allow your outward piety to disguise your inner disregard for the things that really matter. Just have a look now at verse 42, would you? Woe to you Pharisees, for you tithe mint and rue and every herb and neglect justice and the love of God. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others. Tithing was commanded in the Old Testament, but the Pharisees had taken it to an absolute extreme. Mint and rue were common garden herbs. In fact, rue was so common that it just grew along beside the roadside. So tithing rue was a bit like tithing grass or something like that. It was just a wild plant. You can imagine the Pharisee on Celebrity MasterChef. Here's the 90% that I'm going to use for my dish, and here's the 10% that I'll give to show that I'm a decent God-fearer. And then they congratulated themselves on their scrupulous, almost obsessive piety. But, says Jesus, as for genuine love of God, it's long since evaporated. So don't trust in your outward performance. Your display of piety can't disguise your inner poverty. You don't love God. You don't bother with the things that God loves. You despise the idea of justice. Here then is an HR department in the city. It's able to tick every box when it comes to compliance, but in reality, when the board meets, issues of justice, a passion for integrity, fair conduct, is only ever part of the agenda when the in-house lawyer insists that it must be there in order to avoid litigation. You look good on the outside, but is there a heart for God and a passion for justice? Don't think your outward piety can fool God. Here's an employee in the company on a give-as-you-earn scheme. He puts his coin in the collection plate at the carol service. He supports Help for Heroes. His language is politically correct. Her green credentials are immaculate. Great, says Jesus. But don't think your outward display can disguise your inner disregard for the things that God is really concerned about. A heart that loves God and a desire for justice. Woe to you, Pharisee. And then verse 43, you love the best seat in the synagogue and greetings in the marketplace. Oh, they're full of uninhibited self-promotion. It's an extraordinary idea, isn't it? That a person could be going to church in order to be worshipped by men. Isn't that bizarre? And yet the Pharisee went to the synagogue hoping to be placed in the best seat so everybody could see them and he could be slapped on the back and glad-handed by the people that count. I remember when Bill and Hillary Clinton came to London, somebody really unfairly booked them into the Globe Theatre into one of the boxes. And the boxes in the Globe were built so that you go to the play and be seen. They're hopeless for seeing anything. You sit in a box, everybody can see you, you can't see the stage. And somebody commented on the next day how much Bill and Hillary, I mean, obviously they didn't book the tickets, poor things, and somebody was very rude about them being here to be seen rather than actually to watch the play, which I can't imagine was on their agenda, but there we go. Can you imagine going to church in order to be seen by people rather than to worship God? You're full of self-promotion. And finally, you're like an unmarked grave. The grave was made you spiritually unclean if you crossed it. And so, says Jesus, this form of religion, with all its externalism, whether it's Western political correctness and the city's sort of give as you earn and help a London child and all that sort of stuff, all of that that makes you think, well, I'm a decent person. If you buy into that, you're buying into something that is unclean, that actually makes you spiritually contaminated. And those who push it, whether they are the Marxist Pharisees of Soviet Russia or whether they're the Western equivalent or the people in Bangladesh, those who push it are just like unmarked graves. They're like landmines that as you cross them or come in contact with them, spell death. Now, once again, just as we close, of course we can find ourselves here. And of course it convicts us of our own Pharisaical tendencies. All of us, I hope, will have realized that actually there's an element of the Pharisee in every single one of us. But the main direction of this is to help us see through the pretense of the Pharisee, who says, yes, well, I'm a decent Englishman. I'm a decent Buddhist. I've done my Shinto or whatever it happens to be. I'm a decent religious person. And Jesus says, don't think that your externalism can cover over your heart, the greed, the wickedness, the lack of love for God, and the lack of a passion for justice. No, you need to come to Jesus, where you will find you can be forgiven and loved and cleansed and put right with God. Well, let's take a moment's break, and then in a couple of minutes' time for questions. If you want to ask for clarification, please do. As I say, I'm working on this. I very much value your observations on where you think Luke's going, and we'll pick up with the clergy next week. There are some very good questions, as always. Surely there are lots of signs of who Jesus was. Bethlehem, I take it the star, David, Old Testament references, changing the water into wine, enabling the blind to see, etc., etc. I want you to picture in your mind's eye a cone on its side. How would that look? Like that. And I want to suggest to you that, here's a good way of thinking about it, every single sign that you find in the Bible is driving forwards to the point of the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Every single sign finds its fulfillment in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. So all the signs that there are indications that God is going to break into his universe in what David Lennox calls a singular manner. And that singularity, if you like, is the point of the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. It's why when Jesus dies on the cross, he cries out, "It is finished, completed." It's all come to a sort of great climax in the death and resurrection. And that if you then have another cone whose nose meets your cone pointing away, running out from the death and resurrection, what Jesus is saying is the great sign for the world is now the proclamation of that truth. Hence the sign of Jonah, which was both a sign of glorious death and resurrection, but also a proclamation of coming judgment. So that's why I've said there's just one sign, and why I think Jesus says there's just one sign, because actually, ultimately, everything finds its climax in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. That's where it all comes to its crescendo. And then the proclamation of that is the ongoing evidence of who Jesus is. I hope that's a help. How much should, and if you wanted, I could go through every single one of the signs that we find in the scriptures, and we could say, yes, that finds its, this is how it finds its fulfillment. Yes, that does too. That's how it finds its fulfillment, and so on and so forth. How much should we tithe today? Very, very good question. Sorry not to have dwelt on that. Give, verse 41, give as alms those things are that are within, and behold, everything is clean for you. I think what Jesus is saying there is what he's come to do is to bring something radically different to the kind of percentage game. And if we went back to chapter 6, we would see that as he taught the sermon, his equivalent of the Sermon on the Mount, the Sermon on the Plain. That actually what Jesus has come to bring is a complete change of heart, so that I'm not thinking, well, have I given my 10%? But rather, I'm going to give everything. That does not mean that you should get out your checkbook, although it'd be a very nice idea, and write a check for everything you possess to, you know, whatever Christian thing you happen to be fond of as you leave the building. What it means is that all of me is now for the Lord. I've got to live my life and bring up my family if that's you, or, you know, make sure I'm provided for and that sort of thing. So, you know, I mustn't be mindless about it, but actually it's all of me that belongs to the Lord. And so the issue now is not percentage, playing the percentage game, it's how much can I give? And for many of you, 10% may be far too much. I think of our student congregation on a Sunday evening, you know, where they're running up debts all the time, probably 10%, but they will give, I hope, plenty of their time and energy. But for some of you, 10% would be woefully too little. And I hope for many of you, you know, you're giving 50% of what you earn, or something like that, because you don't need it all. And it's a wonderful thing, and a great thing to be able to give to the work of the Lord. Okay, so I hope that's a help. And if you think you do need it all, I recommend that you take a quick trip to Bangladesh for a couple of weeks. That'll help us all. Is the point that they're spiritual death traps, that they are spiritual death traps, or that people simply don't realize that there's a spiritual corpse inside them? I think that they're spiritual death traps. You're like unmarked graves with people walking over them without knowing it. In other words, people, by coming into contact with you and you're sickly religion are actually being spiritually destroyed. Pretty condemning, isn't it? But that's what externalism does to a culture. Actually, I think there can be very few cultures so self-righteous as 21st century materialistic England. All that externalism has created a great, great self-righteousness, equally as powerful as the Victorians, and equally as ugly and dangerous. Well, let's draw to a close there. I hope to see you next week. Next week, as I say, we'll move on to the clergy and the fear of man. I've been preparing it. It's a great thing to be looking at. See you next week.